From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. No one knows how many crimes North Carolina has on its books, not even the UNC professor who literally wrote the book on criminal law in the state. That professor explains why she's pushing for a complete rewrite of the state's criminal code. Governor Roy Cooper wants state lawmakers to raise public school teacher pay. You'll hear legislative leaders explain how they've addressed that goal. The change from a Barack Obama presidency to a Donald Trump presidency means a different approach to property rights. An expert from the Institute for Justice analyzes the change. And we'll discuss some of the challenges linked to health care in remote areas of western North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
When one thinks of the state treasurer's office, it's typically the behind-the-scenes management of the state's investments that comes to mind. But Dale Falwell, who was elected to the job in 2016, is taking a more public and policy-engaged approach to the job. Carolina Journal has been covering the treasurer's activities, and Rick Henderson, editor-in-chief, joins me now. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, just give us a sense in terms of how they approach the job. Compare the current treasurer, Dale Falwell, to our previous treasurer, Janet Cowell. You were living in North Carolina
right
during the Cowell years.
Well, Janet Cowell was someone who was perceived to be extremely competent, very capable. She was someone who was formerly in the General Assembly, as Dale Falwell was as well. And she was someone who really was more typically the idea of someone who was going to manage the state's funds well, was thought of really as a money manager, essentially, and did some policy-oriented things that were caused a bit of concern here at the John Locke Foundation, in which she was talking about social investing and things like moving some of the pension funds into things that benefited politically preferred causes rather than just looking at overall returns. But Janet was very much low-key, sort of nose to the grindstone sort of person, and got high marks for that. Now, Dale Falwell came in with a completely different attitude about it. He was very much of a crusader. He sees himself as an advocate for taxpayers and state employees, and he's someone who is trying to take care of the programs under his supervision, the state pension fund, the state health plan, and make them not only as efficient as possible, increase returns, but also reduce fraud, because essentially I think with any state treasurer, the main thing you assume is that you've got basically a bond between the people, the state employees, and those who are investing in these benefits to make sure that they're delivered properly and that there's no there are no shenanigans going on. But Dale Falwell has really taken this to task and taken it to heart.
You've been covering at Carolina Journal some really interesting developments that he's been involved in the last few weeks. Let's talk first about the state health plan. You mentioned he's in charge of that. He's taking some actions to try to lower premiums mm-hmm. for some members of the state health plan. Tell us what he's doing.
Well, one thing he's doing is that he has basically ordered medical provider rates paid by Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina to be cut by 15%, because he wants to lower premiums for members. And he has argued that a number of state employees really can't afford to, for the premiums in the health plan right now, that they're higher than some, comparable states nearby. At the same time, the, plan itself is not very well funded. And so a lot of it relies on both premiums and annual appropriations for the General Assembly. And what he would like to do is to get it on better financial footing. And so one way that by doing that is that he says that compared with other states, the health plan is paying more than it should to medical providers through pass through with Blue Cross Blue Shield.
He seems to be focusing in terms of premiums on trying to lower the premium for state employees who are on what's called the family plan.
Right, exactly. And that's and one thing about that is that the cost of covering dependents, spouses, and the like is he thinks it's out of line with other comparable things in the private sector, and that part of that is just simply because the state has chosen to pick reimbursement rates that are higher than he thinks they need to be. And so he thinks he could possibly save as much as $1 billion over time. But I think he's talking about something like $300 million a year just by making this one change.
He's also speaking out about any potential issuance of debt should the General Assembly and the governor get together and decide that they want to do that. What's his concern?
Well, the concern is that the according to the state constitution, debt issuances, for the most part, should be handled through voter referendum. The voters, these issuances of debt have to be approved by taxpayers unless the General Assembly makes some sort of special provision. And there is there's a part of the governor's, Governor Roy Cooper's budget, which would have $1.9 billion in new school bonds and then also a $3 billion transportation bond. And there are members of the state house which would like to have that transportation bond out there as well. And it would be repaid, the transportation bond, through the Highway Trust Fund, which is basically fuel taxes and some vehicle registration fees. And the voters would have no say in whether or not this additional $3 billion in debt went out. And the treasurer says, no, sorry, let's not do that. If we're going to take on an additional $3 billion in debt or any additional debt at this point, because we do have, in addition to other outstanding debt, we have the big Connect NC program,
right,
which was passed a couple of years ago. If we're going to take on additional debt, the voters ought to have some say in it, because the money is going to have to be repaid one way or another. I mean, the full faith and credit of the state will be behind that. And if something were to happen that we were to have some sort of financial downturn, or if gas prices got so high that fuel tax collection started going down, then the ability to repay that would be much lower. And if the voters don't get to say that, then that's a problem.
Now, people might be wondering why a transportation bond if we just passed the Connect NC bond. Connect NC did not have road funding in it.
No, it didn't. And that was something that a number of conservative lawmakers have taken issue with, was that the bond was named Connect NC, which gives implications that it was something to do with roads and transportation. It was not. The money almost exclusively went to the university system or to the community colleges for capital construction projects. And those projects may have been needed, but they were not transportation projects. Up till now, the General Assembly has sort of worked around transportation needs by shifting money from the highway funds into transportation funding directly. In the past, that always wasn't the case. But this, actually doing something like this, could affect the ability to repay bonds, if indeed they're doing these projects now sort of as a pay as you go basis. But if they're pushing off the cost of the future, but still having to pay for them out of current receipts, that could cause a problem down the road.
Rick, Treasurer Dale Falwell is also speaking out about some pension reforms that he thinks the state needs.
Right. On the specific cases, there have been instances, one high-profile one recently, in which a man in Florida who was the son of a retired state employee who had retired in Florida had collected something like $250,000 from the pension plan after his mother died.
And oh boy.
Had just essentially never reported to the authorities here in North Carolina that his mother was no longer alive and clearly had the legal power to collect money on her behalf, and did so. And he's just been indicted and charged and will face some court action. So that's one thing, is that he wants to crack down on pension fraud. He also wants to crack down on public employees who commit certain crimes and to make them basically on the hook for having their pensions taken away if they're convicted of certain sorts of crimes. And then finally, there's the issue of pension spiking, where you have a senior, say, local government official who's nearing retirement, and the local government agency decides to boost their salary like crazy the last few years so that it will boost their pension benefits. And he's cracking down on that as well, and he would like to do away with that. And how he's doing that is he's basically saying, if somebody spikes a pension, then I'm going to build a local government that did it, and they're going to have to pay us back.
That will get their attention.
Yes, it will.
We've been talking about the different policy activities and statements that State Treasurer Dale Falwell has been making. You can read these stories that we've been discussing at CarolinaJournal.com. We've been talking with Rick Henderson, who is Editor-in-Chief. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Good luck if you want to try to name every crime in North Carolina. Professor Jessica Smith of the UNC School of Government literally wrote the book on state criminal law. Even she doesn't know all of them.
Not all of the things that have been made criminal are actually found where you'd think they'd be, which is in Chapter 14, which is entitled Criminal Law. In fact, in our general statutes, which are many volumes of green books that I'm sure many of you have, felony offenses are peppered throughout 53 separate chapters of the general statutes, and misdemeanor offenses are peppered throughout 142 separate chapters outside of Chapter 14, which is on criminal law.
Smith shared her thoughts recently with the John Locke Foundation audience. She highlighted concerns about particular types of crime.
Although it's not included anywhere in the general statutes, in North Carolina, it's a crime for a dentist to run an ad and not say whether he's a specialist or a generalist. It's true. It's true. It's a crime. And you might be wondering, how can that be so? It's not in the general statutes. It's not written in our statutes. Well, the answer is that in North Carolina, the law delegates authority to create crimes to administrative bodies and boards. So, for example, a provision in the general statute makes it a crime for a person to violate any rule or regulation that's been adopted by the Board of Dental Examiners, like the one we just talked about. Our crimes are not just peppered throughout the general statutes, felonies in 42 chapters, misdemeanors in 52 and misdemeanors in 142. They're also peppered throughout the administrative regulations.
And crimes go beyond the state's list of rules and regulations as well.
We delegate authority to counties and to cities and to towns and to metropolitan sewerage districts to make things a crime by way of an ordinance. So we have a town that has made it a crime to allow chickens or other domestic fowl to be at large in the town. It's a crime to do that. In another city, anybody here from Rocky Mount? Anybody here from Rocky Mount? Well, in Rocky Mount, there's an ordinance that makes it a crime if you have a business that fronts a paved sidewalk to fail to remove accumulated snow within 12 hours. That's a crime. In another, anybody from Mount Airy? Anybody from Mount Airy here? Nope. Okay. It is a misdemeanor for any person to use Snappin' Pops or Silly Strings within the corporate limits of the city. The town of Curie Beach, it is a misdemeanor to wear thong bathing suits or similar attire. Now listen, you may think that this should be criminal. I get it. But did you know it was? And we're laughing and it's funny, right? But it's serious at the same time, and it's serious for a bunch of reasons. First, the criminal justice system is an expensive system. Because of the procedural protections that attach, it's a big deal to process conduct, regulate conduct through the criminal justice system. And when we're regulating conduct like chickens and snow and silly strings and thongs, people have raised a question about whether that's the best use of public resources. Also, you do need to understand that even a misdemeanor in North Carolina isn't just about the misdemeanor. It's about a host of collateral consequences that attach to that person if they pick up a conviction. And those collateral consequences can interfere with a person's ability to serve in the military, get college financial aid, get a job, the checkbox on the form, have you been convicted, or qualify for professional licensure. So it's actually a serious thing to have a misdemeanor conviction, even if it's a relatively low-level one.
That's Professor Jessica Smith of the UNC School of Government. She's spelling out multiple concerns about North Carolina's criminal code.
There's no central database for collecting all of the things that have been made criminal by administrative boards and bodies and by local governments, such that it's impossible to say today how many things we've made criminal in North Carolina. Now, that has consequences, other consequences as well. It makes it really difficult for people like law enforcement officers, prosecutors, public defenders, and judges to know and understand this vast amount of criminal law that we've created. And maybe more importantly, it undermines a really critical purpose of the criminal law, which is to give us notice as citizens as to what conduct is prohibited so that we can conform our behavior accordingly.
Smith says all of these issues are tied to one major problem.
The root of the problem is that North Carolina lacks a streamlined, comprehensive, orderly, and principled code. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, first, by streamline, I mean it doesn't include all that extra stuff that we don't need. It takes out all the things that are unnecessarily making the code unnecessarily complex, redundant provisions. A comprehensive code means it includes everything we need in there. It defines all the core crimes in one place. It tells us what all the elements are. It defines the required mental state, etc. An orderly and principled code is one that's internally consistent. It doesn't suffer from those oddities that we talked about, where things you just sort of scratch in your head thinking it just doesn't make sense. It complies with the Constitution. It makes efficient use of public resources. I worry that at the heart of this messiness in our code ultimately undermines our criminal law. It undermines the integrity of the law, trust and confidence that we as citizens can have that the law is going to be fairly and consistently applied, the moral authority of the law, and ultimately the criminal law's ability to serve as an effective deterrent to conduct.
Smith spent much of her time highlighting the problem. What's the solution? How does North Carolina go about fixing the situation?
One way that I'm particularly interested in and have been talking to people about is to do something called recodification. And recodification is basically a fancy word to refer to a comprehensive rewriting of the code to create a streamlined, principled, orderly code. The primary goals of recodification include everything you need in there. Make sure you got all your key crimes. Make sure you've got all your key definitions. Take the stuff out that's not needed. Eliminate all the redundancy and the stuff that's making it overly complex. Use plain language that normal people can understand. This will also really help law enforcement officers who are on the scene in the heat of the moment or trying to figure out how they should process a particular crime. Make sure that it's consistent and rational. Those are the issues that we've already touched on. And preserve the legislative judgments. In other words, the General Assembly has already made decisions that certain things should be made criminal and that those judgments can be preserved in a recodification process. Not only the legislature's determinations, but also determinations that our appellate courts have made about the current law. So it's a cleaning up process, but preserving. It's not about being soft on crime. It's about being smart on crime. It's about doing it in a way that's clear and gives better notice and ultimately can help with implementation, the efficiency, the fairness of the administration of the criminal justice system.
That's Jessica Smith, professor at the UNC School of Government. She's making the case for a complete rewrite of North Carolina's criminal code. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Governor Roy Cooper and his Democratic allies are calling on North Carolina's Republican-led General Assembly to raise public school teacher pay. During a recent news conference, State House Speaker Tim Moore responded, "There will be a teacher pay increase, averaging more than 6%.
It's important to note that this commitment actually marks the fifth year that we've increased teacher pay. As you may know, the NEA issued a report showing that this year we were number two in the nation in teacher pay, and the year before that we were number one in the nation. So really we believe that growth is what matters most, particularly when you inherit frozen salaries and billions of dollars of debt like we did when Republicans took over back in 2011. Long-term salary growth is, in fact, what North Carolina teachers need, and that's exactly what they've got. Next year, the average teacher pay will grow to over $53,000, and that's before the local supplements, benefits, or bonuses are included. And we're doing something also very important. We're not raising taxes to do this. In fact, the second year of the tax cuts that are slated in the budget are going to happen just as they are scheduled. We've done that. We've cut taxes. We've cut regulation. We're at a time when more North Carolinians are working today than at any time in our state's history. We're having great economic prosperity, and during that time, we have increased education K-12 spending by billions of dollars.
Senate leader Phil Berger focused on the figure of a $53,000 annual salary for teachers.
That means that teachers will have received an average pay raise of $8,600, 19% compared to the 2013-2014 school year. In fact, more than 40,000 of our state's teachers, nearly half of all public school teachers, will have received at least a $10,000 pay raise on an annual basis during that same period. Republicans have also reformed the entire pay schedule, allowing teachers to reach the top of the scale much more quickly. When we started in January 2011, it took teachers 32 years to go from beginning pay to the top of the pay schedule. With the budget we're going to adopt this year, that trek is only 15 years. We've cut in half the time teachers need to go from beginning to the top of the pay scale. And under that pay plan, put in place by our Republicans, a teacher will earn approximately $233,000 in base pay alone, more over the course of their career, as compared to the old plan that was in place under the Democrats.
That's State Senate Leader Phil Berger joining House Speaker Tim Moore. They're touting their record of boosting pay for North Carolina public school teachers. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The shift from a Barack Obama presidency to a Donald Trump presidency has led to major changes in federal government policy. Well, how have those changes affected things like economic liberty, private property rights? Our next guest has been watching these issues. Scott Bullock is president and general counsel at the Institute for Justice. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Of course, the change from having Barack Obama in the White House to Donald Trump has led to major changes on many fronts. Your group follows issues such as economic liberty, private property rights, First Amendment. Have you seen any major changes in the year plus since we shifted from Barack Obama to Donald Trump as president?
Well, we've certainly seen some changes at the federal level and the issues that we care about. A lot of our issues arise in state and local governments. And one of the things that we always emphasize to people is that regardless of who's in power, people in power tend to abuse it. And the Constitution is there to protect citizens' rights against these abuses of power. And again, regardless of who's in power, we have to have an engaged judiciary which holds the executive and legislative branches to account for their activities as well. So that's something that we always remain focused on is constitutional principles and calling out folks for violations of those constitutional principles. And we've seen at the federal level, and what we're very dedicated to doing is standing up for constitutional rights and praising the administration when it goes in a direction that favors more individual freedom, and denouncing it and challenging it when it violates constitutional rights. And so at the federal level, One of the encouraging things that we've seen is the Department of Labor has a renewed interest in talking about occupational licensing laws, which have so interfered with economic liberty rights that it's one of these issues that is really there's a broad consensus really across the ideological spectrum that these are a real problem and that something needs to be done about them. The ability of folks to work for a living is impeded by these onerous occupational licensing laws. Even President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors recognized that. And now the Labor Secretary, Alex Acosta, under the Trump administration, has made this a priority in talking about this and trying to get states to open up these professions to many newcomers.
I imagine that one other thing that could be a positive sign that we've seen is this focus on regulatory rollback. A lot of times these regulations trample on private property rights, so a focus on that could be a welcome sign.
That's right. Of looking at regulations and seeing how much government is interfering with people's economic liberty rights, private property rights, and to really be thinking about the impact that this has on people's lives. I mean, occupational licensing is one of those issues that affects people really on the kind of bottom rungs of the economic ladder, entry-level occupations that people can't get into because they don't meet these onerous requirements that are imposed in so many different states. So any approach that looks at these regulations and wants to see which ones are in keeping with constitutional principles, which ones violate them, and making some decisions based upon that is encouraging.
We are chatting with Scott Bullock, who is president and general counsel at the Institute for Justice. Some people might be listening to us and saying, things were bad under Barack Obama, things are better under Donald Trump. But when it comes to the issues that your group focuses on, it's not necessarily that cut and dry. There are some things in which you see what the Trump administration has done and say, well, we kind of wish they hadn't gone that way.
Right. In the way that we're encouraged by what the administration is doing on occupational licensing, we are very concerned about what's happening on the issue of civil forfeiture. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is a big champion of civil forfeiture laws. And what he wants to do is to make it easier for the federal government to work with state and local governments in order to take private property again. And that is something that has to be challenged. And we are looking – we're doing that through lawsuits and trying to get Congress involved in this as well. And this impacts directly people in North Carolina as well because North Carolina has – good civil forfeiture laws at the state level, but a lot of local law enforcement agencies here work with the feds in order to take property, and Attorney General Sessions wants to encourage that and revive a lot of these programs that were actually restricted in some way under the Obama administration. So that's very dangerous. It's a threat to private property owners, and we're going to challenge it.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of the work that IJ does is based on the state and local level. In recent years, have you seen a major change in the way that governments are approaching these issues? Has there been an improvement? Have things gotten worse? About the same?
Yeah, I mean, we thankfully on a lot of the issues in which we're litigating and challenging, we have seen improvements because of some of the work we've done that other groups have done on issues like occupational licensing, civil forfeiture laws, eminent domain, which is another issue that we've been very involved in, but one of the things that we've recognized that these battles are never entirely finished. Governments always must be held accountable. The Constitution must be enforced, and it takes groups like ours and others and citizens that are willing to stand up and protect their rights. And that's the only way that constitutional limits on government can be enforced. The Constitution is just words on a piece of paper. It takes determined citizens, determined advocates to stand up for these rights every generation because we know those in power are going to be there and they tend to abuse their power and they have to be held to account.
Rights can be threatened in a number of ways. At the Institute for Justice, do you see a particularly challenging threat that's sort of number one on the list at this point?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's number one or two with it. We see kind of these threats to liberty across a wide there's a wide array of rights that are being challenged, and one of the things that we've recognized too is that governments are always kind of coming up with innovative ways to threaten private property rights, economic liberty rights, personal freedom. So we have to stay one step ahead of the government, and we have to always be looking ahead to what's coming down the pike, because if somebody's not watching and somebody's not challenging these actions, people in power tend to abuse it.
If someone is out there feels his or her private property rights or economic liberty have been challenged and want to know a little bit more about the ways they could fight back, is there a way for them to find out more about what the Institute for Justice is doing?
Sure. We have a website, which is fairly easy. It's ij.org. And we have a lot of information about our cases. We have a form on there that people can fill out that allows people to contact us if they might have a potential case. We look for very specific things in our cases that will increase the likelihood that we'll be able to set precedent that not just benefits the people we represent, but a wide swath of folks. So we're always looking for great cases to take this on, and we represent people who might not otherwise be able to afford it. We're supported by people who believe in what we're doing, and we're grateful to be able to represent hundreds of people from across the country.
Once again, that website is ij.org. The president and general counsel of the Institute for Justice, Scott Bullock, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The medical plight of rural North Carolina is getting the attention of state lawmakers. In fact, there's actually a special committee devoted to this very issue. Now, in western North Carolina, access to care is particularly spotty. Dan Way is associate editor of Carolina Journal. He covers health care for CJ, and he's been looking into the issue. He joins us now. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
Let's talk about rural access to care in general. I know you've been reporting on this for a number of months now. What have you found? What's our issue in North Carolina?
Well, there are the haves and the have-nots, and there are, especially in the economically distressed counties, they also seem to be those who have the most challenges being medically underserved. There's all manner of shortages in terms of doctors, dentists, specialists, hospitals. And most people who live in those areas have to travel great distances to get the care that they need.
What areas of the state are we talking about, Dan?
The problems persist throughout the state, but the biggest pockets, the ones that are most challenged, seem to be in the western part of the state, the mountain regions, and down east.
So folks who live in the more urban and suburban areas tend to have much easier access, but once you get outside of that, then it's questionable?
Exactly.
You traveled to western North Carolina recently as part of your in-depth reporting on this. Why did you go there?
Well, just looking at some of the maps where some of the shortages are, the western part of the county has some unique challenges. And plus, I'd never been out there, so
<It's>
I tried to kill two birds with one stone. But given the mountains and some of the other characteristics out there that add to the difficulties, I thought it would be an interesting place to do a microcosm of the story at large.
You actually went way, way, way west over towards the Tennessee border.
Yep, right on the border.
You spent some time in Graham County. Tell us a little bit about Graham County in general.
Well, Robbinsville is the largest town in the county. It's the county seat. It has fewer than 1,000 people.
Wow.
The county has one grocery store. Until the beginning of April, it had one community health center. That was the only place people could go to find a doctor. Now an urgent care center has just opened up and to great fanfare. Now imagine that if you live here in Raleigh or in the Triangle area or the Triad, there's a doc in a box on every corner, it seems. Mm-hmm. Over there, this was the first one that opened in the county. And so it was a greatly welcomed addition to the medical establishment.
Dan, how have folks in that area then been getting their care? Whether it's a dentist, a doctor, I mean, what if you break a bone or what if you have a car accident? What do?
Well, you travel. And oddly enough, while some people recognize that, yeah, that's a problem, they seem to take it in stride. This is part of what we do out here. It's something that they kind of take for granted. You know, they think that it's a fair exchange for living in an urban area where you have other problems, you know, with more social issues, crime, traffic.
What you're describing is I termed when I was growing up as that rugged individualism. I grew up in the Southwest, and there's a lot of that same type of mentality, that the acceptance that there is a trade-off for the things that you're able to do and maybe the freedoms you're able to enjoy versus what you don't have access to.
Right. Not there. You'll hear it variously described as mountain culture or right. frontier mentality. It is a rugged individualism. This is an area that was hewn from a very rugged landscape, loggers, farmers, people who had to make do on their own. So there's a fierce independence out there, which is part of the problem, too, when it comes to seeking help.
Really? Tell us more about that.
Well, you know, if you talk to the social services folks, they say they have a difficult time getting people to come in. And, of course, that's one of the places where people could be screened for help. They don't often want to ask for help, so they'll deal with some of their health issues by themselves. You know, they won't go get care. They don't want to take charities because of that, you know, fierce independence. So this complicates things as you move farther along in your health condition. It can deteriorate, which then causes bigger problems downstream.
That sets up a really interesting challenge then for state lawmakers and advocates for greater access to care. On the one hand, these are folks who are trying to make things better, so to speak, for people who are living in the mountain counties, but they're running up against people who may not be completely accepting of the help.
I think that's right, you know, but I also think they're open to some issues of help. In the schools, for instance, they did have a program for a while that had a physician assistant there giving care. That was a grant-funded thing. It ran out. So it's not that they're averse to it, but probably the folks at the top of the hierarchy are the ones who are more likely to push it.
An interesting piece of one of your stories on this whole issue of access to care in the rural areas has to do with a big motorcycle mecca, as you call it, that is in Graham County?
Well, Tail of the Dragon is actually not in Graham County, but Graham County Emergency Services serves a part of it. What happens is that many of the motorcyclists who go there come through Graham County, so it's a base camp for a lot of folks that come through on motorcycles who want to tackle this incredible 12-mile stretch of highway that has 318 curves in 11 miles.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
yes. So is this well-known around the country?
Probably more well-known around the country than it is in North Carolina
right.
in many instances.
I'd never heard of it, I admit. So when I read your story, Dan, at CarolinaJournal.com, I thought, what gives here? I'd never heard of this.
Yeah, so it covers covers 4 miles of Swain County, and it goes into Tennessee. And there are a lot of crashes up in that area. And Chiricahua Skyway, which is another road there, has a vast number of motorcycle crashes, all of which help Graham County become one of the worst counties in the state for motorcycle crashes and vehicle crashes in total.
And the reason that you focused on this in terms of access to care is because of those crashes you're talking about. What happens when someone crashes in an area where there's not a whole lot of care available?
Well, if you're up on Tail of the Dragon or out in the Chiricahua Skyway, it can be 35, 40 minutes before an ambulance arrives, assuming there's an ambulance available. There's only two ambulances in the Graham County Emergency Services, so they stay very busy. And as one fellow put it, you can bleed out before the ambulance even gets to you, much less get you back down off the mountain through all those curves and winding, treacherous roads to a base camp where they can bring in a helicopter to evacuate you out.
Dan, you've written that there's a special legislative committee that is looking at the broad issue of access to care in the rural parts of the state. Have we gotten an inkling of any recommendations they're looking at or any particular areas or problems they're trying to solve?
Haven't seen it yet, but they're looking at telemedicine, which would allow specialists and other doctors far away to communicate by electronic tablets and other technological devices so that they can get advice there.
Are you expecting
there's
any
some
movement?
Scope of practice issues too. These things always come up every year. Mm-hmm. Hopefully some of these things will start to move, but I'm not so confident it'll happen in this short session.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.